Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello, hello. A very warm welcome in to RNIB Tech Talk, the UK blind and low vision community's opportunity to come together each week to explore the world of technology. Don't forget, of course, Tech Talk, you first catch us each Tuesday lunchtime at 1, Thursday evenings at 9, Saturday tea time at 5, or if you prefer a podcast, search for RNIB Tech Talk or ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of RNIB Tech Talk. We're always keen to hear from you, so why not drop us a line, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K @rnib.org.uk. Always keen to receive your emails or even a voice note. Imagine that. Joining me this week is my co-host, Callum Stoneman. I'll come to you in a second, Callum. We are going to be heading to the future as part of RNIB Connect Radio's 20th anniversary celebrations. We're thinking about what the next 20 years of accessible technology may bring us. We'll also be hearing some of your thoughts and reflections on last week's show and some of your technology from the past. But welcome in, Callum Stoneman. How are you doing, sir?
Thank you. Yeah, doing pretty well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. So last week, of course, we had Apple's Wanderlust event introducing the Apple Watch Series 9, a new Apple Watch Ultra, and of course, iPhone 15 and 15 Pro. Any of that interesting you, tickling your fancy? Are you going to get the credit card out?
I don't think I'll be upgrading, to be honest. I've got a 13 Pro, which is still doing me very nicely, but there is some interesting stuff there. You could say quite small upgrades, but there is some stuff that could have huge accessibility benefits. One thing that really stood out to me, which I don't think is really being talked about much, is this new I think they're calling it the Ultra Wideband 2 chip. So this is what, if you've got an AirTag, this is what gives you the precision finding, where it will guide you to the AirTag. And they've extended this so it can give you that guidance from a much kind of further distance. And one of the examples they gave, even in the mainstream event, they didn't kind of sell this as an accessibility thing. But one of the examples they gave is that if you're trying to find somebody, so if you're trying to find a friend in a big crowd or just a big place and you're some distance away, you can get guidance towards each other. And you know, for us as blind people, imagine if, you know, if you've got two visually impaired people trying to find each other, or if you're just trying to find someone. Obviously, we'll have to see how it works in the real world, but I thought that could be really cool. That could be really interesting.
It does sound interesting. Do you both need to have that second generation ultra wideband chip to make that work? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the downside for now. I think it's going to be a while before we really see it. It's kind of, you know, we see everyone using it. That's why I'm not sort of jumping into it, because yeah, it would only work if someone else has got a 15.
Righto. And then the other thing from an accessibility point of view that I found quite interesting was that the new Apple Watch has got this new gesture where you can tap your thumb and your first finger together. So you essentially can do the magic tap, and again, you know, touted as a sort of a mainstream feature rather than something that's accessibility specific. But from our perspective, I'm thinking about, you know, if you've got a cane in the other hand or you're using a guide dog and maybe you want to respond to something on your watch, then that could be super helpful as well.
Yeah, massively. They've given three examples, I think, answering and hanging up a phone call, play pause music. And I think if there's a timer ringing or an alarm going, it can stop the alarm as well. So a few useful little things there. And again, this is an accessibility feature that's come to the mainstream, because has been in voiceover for quite a while. Not very reliable, if you ask me. I've never really got it to work. I think there's a bit of a knack to it. But if you go into the watch app on your iPhone and go to voiceover, there is a hand gestures section where you can do a similar thing. But I think this brings a couple more features to it, and obviously everyone can use it.
And also in the whole area of accessibility, I'm interested on the phone that we've got the action button now.
Yes,
on the Pro
really good.
Phones. Yeah, so you could assign that to an accessibility feature like VoiceOver or the magnifier. So if you only use those features in certain situations and you need to be able to very, very quickly turn them on and off. I mean, we've always had the, triple tap and all that kind of thing, or you can use Siri to turn those things off, but I imagine just pressing the action button is going to be a lot quicker and a lot more reliable.
Yeah, and you can assign those to Siri shortcuts as well, so you could have the action button, you could press it and it would turn on Do Not Disturb, or you could press it and, I mean, I'm thinking of an easy way to get to Be My Eyes or Aira.
Yes indeed, yeah,
just tap that button and the app opens up.
And it will be very interesting to find out whether, now that USB-C is a thing on iPhone 15, whether that will support wired connections to Braille displays.
Yeah.
You can already do this if you buy like the dongle with certain displays. But, the most frequently asked question about using Braille with your phone is usually getting the Bluetooth. Why doesn't the Bluetooth reconnect, or why didn't this happen, or whatever? So actually having a wired connection between your Braille display and your phone might be a good thing.
Yeah, just plug it straight in.
Well, we'll have to test that to find out if it works. Well, brilliant stuff.
You're thinking of upgrading, aren't you, from your old SE? You're maybe a little bit tempted, you were saying the other day.
Shh, I might have.
Oh, sorry, does Mrs. Williams not know about that one?
Ah, yes, well, about that. So there we are. If you have pushed the button and you now have your new product on its way, let us know how you're getting on with it. We're keen to hear about that. Or if you're happy to sit this one out and you've got good reasons, then let us know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Callum Stoneman, stick around. It's another Tech Talk. Throughout the month of September, as you know, we are celebrating 20 years of the station. And here on Tech Talk last week, we were exploring some of that vintage retro technology that blind and partially sighted people used to use way back in 2003 and beyond. Well, this week, as promised, we are looking to the future. What might accessibility look and feel like and sound like in 2043? And the years between now and then, and of course beyond. And to help us with this task, we have assembled a panel. Robin Spinks is the inclusive design lead here at RNIB. Ant Morse has written a book about the future, The Future of Us, that attempts to answer some of these questions. And Stacey works in accessibility and publishing. Welcome all. I'm sure you'll be much better at introducing yourselves than I am. So let's just come round to each of you and get you to just tell us a little bit about some of the things that you're working on currently. Stacey, I'm going to come to you first.
Hi, my name is Stacey Scott, and I currently work in accessibility and publishing, as well as more broadly DEI work. But I am a massive technology fan. Ever since I picked up the first Nokia back in the day, I was hooked, and it's enabled me to, it's opened up the world to everything for me. And so I'm incredibly excited to look forward to the next 20 years.
Ant?
Hi there, I'm Ant Morse. I'm the head of innovation at Virgin Media O2. I'm a futurist and author of the book, The Future of Us. And my areas of research are not only on the technology, but most importantly, how the technology will evolve us as a society and as an economy as well.
And Robin.
Hi folks, I'm Robin Spinks. I'm head of inclusive design at RNIB, and I, like Stacey and others, love technology. Become very interested in smartphones early on, followed their development, and I'm probably one of those people that tends to have a device on one platform in one pocket and the device in the other pocket operates on the other platform. So trying to just keep a foot in both camps and follow it, and optimistic. Cautiously optimistic about the future, I think.
Now, to get to 2043, we've got to get through the rest of 2023. And one of the hot topics this year, of course, is AI. So I would be interested to hear from each of you about how you envision the future of AI and accessibility for blind and partially sighted people. Which developments in AI currently excite you the most? Stacey, let's come to you first.
From a person who works in publishing, of course, there's the aspect of AI describing images for us. And so I feel like at the moment we're starting to turn a corner and see some really interesting things coming out. Even if you look at, you know, social media platforms and the descriptions you're starting to get, I think in the next few years we're going to see that build and build. And so no longer will you have to turn to your, you know, friend or family member and say, oh, I really want to know what that picture is, or what event are they advertising, because there's just no alt text and there's no way of knowing, because it just says graphic or picture. And so to get to a place where actually we just have to listen to voiceover or whatever, talk back, whatever we're using, and it will tell us through AI exactly what that picture is, what the writing says in it, and we don't have to rely on anyone to get that information.
And in your book, you talk a lot about AI and how AI is going to help us with our productivity. You talk about cobotics. If you could just explain a bit more about that and tell us which AI developments excite you the most.
Absolutely. And I think the it's a really continuation from what Stacey said there around it bringing a descriptive view to what's available. If we think about this in a specific AI solution option, for me it's digital assistance. This is not just going to change from an accessibility perspective, it's going to transform pretty much everything. Certainly the future of work will be completely different. And to bring this to life, let me give you an example. So I recently returned from holiday. I must have had 260 emails and kind of sighed as I sat to my desk and started to wade through the task of replying. But imagine this. Imagine that AI is intelligent to a very basic level, so realistically intelligent, to have read every single email that's in my inbox. Now, it could do that in a matter of seconds, and it could then immediately take those 260 emails and categorize them and say, these are clearly, you know, junk email or spam. And it can deal with those accordingly. It could then say, these are interesting, and it feels as though you need to pick them up as a priority, and it could start to rank and stack. Interestingly, I don't need to be in front of my laptop. What's to stop me just putting my AirPods in and sitting back over a coffee and a digital assistant taking me through what emails have come in? The bit where it'll get really interesting is when it starts to do more. And that is where it starts to predict replies. And this, I wrote about this many, many years ago, and it's now starting to come true. Microsoft Copilot is a solution we'll start to see more of, and Google have got a system of called AI called Duet. And these are services that will predict replies, a couple of things. One might be the language that you use to communicate with that person. So if it was Robin as an example, it would read all the emails that me and Robin have sent to each other, understand our relationship, understand the language, and then start to predict how I may reply. It could just quickly tell me what Robin asked for in summary, the reply it's going to suggest, and I could just say send. We could get through emails much, much quicker in this type of environment. But it won't stop there. It will, you know, it will start to do that for many, many more tasks. So I think it will transform everything and give us more options of work as well.
Robin, how do you see AI shaping the future of accessibility?
I'm with Ant and Stacey on both of those things. I'm actually super excited about both of those things personally. But another one that I want to bring to the table is this. Now, a guide dog is a phenomenal resource for a blind person. Guide dogs are incredible. The organisation that trains them is fantastic. And I think you can just never underestimate the wonder of having a well-trained guide dog. But wouldn't it be fantastic if there were other options that sat alongside that, not to try and be superior to a guide dog, but just to be able to say to people, you've got options. And I think having an AI guided bot, for example, that you might even be able to have your hand on the top of it and it move along, or have another device that you carry or wear on your person, and it can deliver a comparable level of mobility and orientation to a well-trained and obedient guide dog. I think that's a super exciting prospect for a a lot of us, for a lot of our friends and the community. And it's something that I can see we're edging closer towards. If you think about Spot the Robot Guide Dog, but then think about the kind of developments we've seen in generative AI, as Ant mentioned, in the last year even. You know, what we're seeing tipping out from Microsoft and Google right now, we're at a really exciting time, I think, for the ability to get around and navigate spaces and just give people confidence and more choice.
Indeed. And you and I, of course, Robin, are big fans of Aibo's, Sony's robotic dog that they bring to the California State University Technology Conference each spring. And, I didn't want to like it, but I couldn't help myself. And the way it interacts, the way it gives you that sort of attention. And for somebody maybe who doesn't have the capacity to look after a physical dog, you know, that might be a good option for them as well.
It's tremendous. Do you know what? I mean, actually, one of the first things that I did when I met Aibo, the robot dog from Sony, the first thing that I did was I tickled its tummy because I wanted to find out if it did what a dog does. If you tickle a dog's tummy for long enough, it quivers and then it rolls over. Right? And I just wanted to see whether that's what would happen. And they've done an incredible job in mimicking real dog behaviour. It's quite remarkable.
And in The Future of Us, the first 30 pages of the book are given over to describing a virtual assistant you call Scout. And one of the interfaces to Scout is using a kind of a headset, I suppose, an augmented reality headset, blending the real world and the virtual world. Virtual reality as well, where you have a completely immersive experience, is also never far from our minds. Just thinking about AR and VR, what do you think that means for accessibility? When we were preparing this session, you know, Stacey said, I'm not really sure about virtual reality. Are we going to be able to use it? And I was reminded, of course, in the early 90s, blind and partially sighted people were told we'd never use Windows. 20 years ago, we were told we'd never use touchscreens. So do you think accessibility and virtual reality will complement each other, or do you think there's some battles there?
No, I think they will, actually. And I think there's two different parts to it, and a third, which is an addition. So there's two specific technologies. Let's start with virtual reality. So that is about immersion into a space. And I think that will be used in therapy, especially solutions in the market that can enhance the experience. But I think really virtual reality will be niche. It will be very specialist in kind of health and therapy apps. Augmented reality is where the digital overlay of these, you know, millions of billions of things that are connected through the Internet of Things become accessible. Now, obviously, the augmented reality is usually a glass, or if we think to Apple's Vision Pro headset, it's about seeing those interactions. But it doesn't have to be. If we think to that voice assistant that I mentioned earlier, if you had a headset on that was looking out as well as projecting information to your peripheral vision, you could actually use that to say, what is in front of me? So it could give an audio description of an environment. And I know there's solutions that do this already, but it's not just that it would not only interact with its environment, but also the millions of things in the environment. So, for example, regardless of it being sight loss or not, if you're walking down a street following some directions, it could interact with sensors locally, whether that's let's say a coffee shop, and it could then tell you there's a great offer at a coffee shop, and it knows what coffee you drink, and then it could offer you, you know, to the directions to that coffee shop's door. Interestingly, those voice assistants will do more. So it would say, would you like to place an order in advance? You've 200 meters away. So you could say, yeah, I'll have a flat white and whatever additions you want, a croissant or whatever that goes with it. And then it directs you directly to the door, and then you could interact with the environment because it's part of that application. So I think we'll see an interaction, and they call it the collisions of technology. So, Internet of Things with augmented reality solutions complemented by voice assistants, I think will be a massive, massive opportunity. And the reason I stress it's going to be a massive opportunity is throughout my research, there's always one guiding factor. There's two, I guess. One is it useful? But two is, will it make any money? So if you follow the money, then it has an interest. So whether, regardless of who it's marketing to, if we're all walking down the street and we get suggested to a great coffee shop for a great cup of coffee, there's a fee for that. There's a, you know, it's almost like search, but in reverse. That there's a great offer that I may be interested in. So it could be a coffee shop, it could be a food outlet, it could be a store, but it's proactively coming to me. Now, there is a bit that people will say, oh, yeah, but what about the data protection? Well, that's something I'd be prepared to surrender. I'd prepare to say, I like coffee. If somebody knows I like coffee, big deal. I'm not really that concerned. If somebody says, oh, well, I know your location, well, again, that might actually keep me safe as well as give me a great experience. So I'm not too precious about that. But obviously that has to be balanced. But yeah, I think this augmented reality with voice will open up a whole heap of possibilities for every user.
Yeah, we'll definitely dig into some of those ethical concerns in a moment. Robin Spinks, you lead RNIB's inclusive design efforts. What do you think virtual reality and augmented reality mean for accessibility?
I'm super excited about it. I mean, I think seeing, for example, the kind of device that Apple has developed in Apple Vision Pro, I'm really excited about that type of what they're calling spatial computing, what that might offer. And one of the obvious opportunities for me is we all know in the sight loss sector that the orientation and mobility industry is in a state of chaos, and it's difficult to fill vacancies, it's difficult to recruit, people are not staying in the profession, so it's a really challenging place to be. I think there's a very obvious opportunity to harness this type of technology so that we can enable people who are newly diagnosed as visually impaired to have a mobility lesson with a person, but then to also introduce a VR type solution where you're able to learn about the depth of the steps that are in your local environment, the route from your house to the train station, what businesses are available en route, what facilities are there that you could also utilize, and you could almost practice the route from your house to the train station or to the library or to your work or wherever you're going from the comfort of your own living room. And then you could go out and do it in the real world. So it's that opportunity to blend a virtual experience with a real experience that ultimately will enable people to improve their confidence and develop their skills and increase their independence. So, you know, there's one example. I think there are many more like that. So I'm optimistic about it. I think the key consideration is that the tools develop with accessibility embedded. I've got a lot of confidence in, for example, Apple, and we know that they've made great efforts already to embed accessibility into Apple Vision Pro. Looking forward to trying that soon. But you know, for all of the other guys in that space, they need to be serious about accessibility so that if you're a screen reader user or you require magnification or larger text, you've got all of that customization baked in. You know, that's a sort of design critical element that, you know, I would want to see across the board.
Stacey, having heard Ant and Robin, what are you thinking?
I mean, yeah, it certainly sounds like there's a lot of positive things ahead. For me, I guess I have this dream vision that, so one of my passions is tech, as you know, the other is travel, so all the T's basically. And so I just love to see this environment where, you know, I go somewhere abroad, and I've got, you know, some AI solutions and wearables, and perhaps I'm using AR or VR to get an understanding of where I am. And so I don't have to either A, feel like I'm missing out on what I'm passing in a new environment, particularly when I'm traveling to experience a new city, or I don't have to rely on having a sighted person with me to literally say, oh, this market's selling X, this market's selling Y, this is a shop doing this, and they're out of breath and, you know, desperately trying to give me all the detail that I need. But actually, if I could have that in my ears, you know, through bone conducting headphones, and feel like actually that I'm traveling like anyone else would and could, that for me is the dream. And so I guess it's about AR and VR, but it's pulling all this technology together to enable people to go and live their dreams. And so that for me, that would be mine. Now, I don't know if that means I can ever just get on a speedboat and head out into the ocean on my own, but I definitely give it a go.
Wow. Yeah. Well, let us know how you get on. Robin, Robin, thinking about wearable tech then, of course, it's not just, you know, headsets. There are lots of other bits of wearable tech out there. And thinking about accessibility and what's on the horizon, how might wearable tech help us in the future?
Well, I was casting my mind back to the Coronado Bay there as Stacey was talking, where we all had a shot in a speedboat a few years ago. That was quite fantastic. But, you know, I think in terms of wearable tech, we'll start to see different form factors. So I still feel quite a liberation from putting, you know, a Pixel Buds into my ears and walking around and just single tapping to get information from Google. It's wonderful. It does help me to be more independent, but I want to extend that. I want those buds to ultimately be not blocking my ear. So I'd like them to be bone conduction, as Stacey said, but I'd also like them to have a level of proximity awareness that I can customize. So I can say, if I'm the tourist going to Milan, for example, I can customize the different levels of verbosity that I want, the different levels of information, and I can make it specific. I mean, that would be incredible, wouldn't it? To be able to say, I'm going on holiday, these are the things I'm interested in. I'd also like to pick up on, you know, are there, for example, local art stalls where there are, you know, local artists who've done pictures. So I was in South Africa and I really wanted to get a hold of an oiled canvas. So, you know, a canvas painting that someone had done out in the wilds with animals and sunrise and, you know, mountains and so on. I wanted to get that. I had to ask a local person where I would be likely to find that, and they directed me to it. I'd love it if the technology could help me out with that and direct me to the streets, the stalls. It could let me know what was around me. So I think it's just greater location awareness, but it's also being more flexible in terms of form factor, giving you more control. You know, ultimately you want something that can enable you to be as independent as possible, and you don't then have to travel with someone else or ask someone else for help. I think that's what a lot of people would like to have, that level of independence. And it's also about developing confidence with the tech. And I think that's something we've all got to do as the tech becomes more sophisticated, more capable, more multi-talented. We've got to build our confidence and our own skills and abilities to get the most from it.
In gaming, you can simply add attributes to a character. And I guess the ultimate wearable tech is technology that will be able to endow us with faculties that maybe we didn't have. Stacey, you worked really hard to make sure that people have access to publishing and access to books. You know, what if you could just say, right, I'm going to pay my, you know, $8.99, and then suddenly, you know, cognitively, I have the sense of I've read that book, I know what was in that book. You don't actually have to, you know, go through the you know, laborious physical business of actually reading the book. You just have it. It's kind of onboarded in your brain. Is anyone even thinking that far ahead?
I don't think anyone that I would interact with is thinking that far ahead. You'd have to speak to like Elon Musk's connections, I think, for that one. I think that would be that's definitely next level stuff. It's a very interesting concept because, you know, with that in mind, you know, we could complete our school years in a matter of, you know, 2 months. And we'd all have read a million books and create a super intelligent human race. I don't know if I'd like that, though. I really enjoy reading a book. I enjoy, you know, finding out as I go along. So I don't know if I'd like to sort of do that or, you know, take a pill, which means I've eaten an entire meal and that's that dealt with. That's not for me. But, you know, it's all about choice. So, you know, if it can happen and people want it.
And you've probably done the most research into this area.
I was chomping at the bit to add to this. So yeah, absolutely. I think there's a middle ground. So will we get to that kind of you know, a pill to eat a meal and a you know, a chip to have passed an exam? I'm not sure, but I think there is the middle ground of things as a service. So for example, if my voice assistant was going through my emails and saying, you know, I'm going to send this reply, let's say I was a lawyer. the bar exam as a digital assistant, does that in theory then make me capable of being a lawyer? Could I, take a legal brain digital assistant as a service and function as a lawyer? So I think that type of thing will be very big. And I think if we look at the early days of AI, going back to IBM's early forays into this, that was definitely their focus, was industry as a service. So becoming a lawyer as one example, but you could extend that out so that when it's replying to my emails, and I obviously work in telecommunications, it could understand our language, our industry, our terminology, our acronyms. So that I think it's a kind of a middle ground, halfway there maybe.
Indeed. I wonder whether, the future of publishing, like this weekend, I was reading your book, and I almost imagine that we can't be that far away from a point where I can say to an app, I've got 2 hours to read Ant's book, and it will basically, the AI will make me a version of that book that fits within the window that I have available.
Yeah, I think that's already there now. So
Yeah.
you can summarize text in many existing applications to say read this entire article and then give me a shortened summary of it. So I think that will definitely be of use. And again, the future of work is not about doing more. It's actually about doing less. The 9 to 5 is nearly 100 years old. Before that, it was ridiculous long hours in mills and in dangerous environments. We naturally evolve and progress to work smarter as a human race. This is our next time. We're going to use services like AI to work less and more intelligently. And the important thing is, and this is something I'm very passionate about, is who gets that time back? If AI does half of my job for me, who gets the time back? And it's one to debate, but working more intelligently, more efficiently, and the byproduct of this is more accurately. The job I do will be improved and enhanced and done better, whether it's through an industry AI expert giving me the right answer each time and checking my work, or whether it just be that it's far more efficient because it knows it. I think there's so many benefits.
Certainly reading those early pages of your book, Ant, I did feel a little bit depressed because, the sort of the protagonist, you sort of got up and sat in your spare room, and I was a bit worried about you. You didn't really seem to go anywhere, and I'm just interested in your thoughts on autonomous vehicles to take us to other places. Do we need them, and how do we make them accessible?
Absolutely, and it is. It paints an interesting picture to understand, and the whole debate then of the social interaction with the future of work, doing less and doing it more efficiently in remote environments. How do we get together? Well, I think there's also a great possibility of the future, which is if you think about everything we do day in, day out, from parcels being delivered to our doors to us posting things back to suppliers or exchanging items or shopping delivered to our door. I foresee that there is a great opportunity here for autonomous vehicles and a network of autonomous vehicles to do two things. One, transport us, and two, transport things. And if you imagine AI running a fleet of, let's say, 1 million autonomous vehicles, we could interact with that. And I could say, I'd like to go to the shopping centre, it's 6 miles away, and I want to go this afternoon. It could immediately come back and say, funny you should ask that. We have a parcel that we're collecting from 2 doors down. Well, it doesn't need to give me this information, to be honest, but this is how it would work. It would say, I'm collecting a parcel 2 doors down and I'm taking it to another location. Using optimized route planning, it could say, we'll pick you up on the way. That vehicle then just literally turns up at my door, and a bit like your kind of Uber experience now, it tells me that it's on its way, that it's getting close. I can reject the journey if something urgent pops up because it's coming anyway, right? So it's efficient, and from a sustainability perspective, it makes sense for me just to jump into that vehicle and be taken somewhere. It's fantastic. The other reason for this is, as our lives evolve with this digital world, we're going to pay for more things as a service. We're going to own far less, but we're going to have far more. If you think of houses and vehicles, these are the most expensive purchases we make. These will be the first things that we don't buy in the future. We'll rent homes and we'll rent vehicles. Well, I think this is an evolution of renting a vehicle. This is renting it for that specific journey and not the rest of the time. So I think it's inevitable it will happen. I guess it's a question of when and who joins up those services, because we'll have this huge competitive landscape where, you know, obviously we have Amazon vehicles delivering things to our door. There's many other delivery services. It's how do we get to that bit that says, I'm going to make better use of our trip or our fleet that does this anyway. So groceries to your door, you to other places, and so on. You know, just keep adding the what ifs to it.
Stacey, would you jump in an autonomous vehicle?
I definitely would, yes. I would love to say that I can see a future where, you know, me as a blind person could just nip out, get into my car and head down the shops or to see a friend or, I don't know, drive from London to Scotland. I think that would be amazing. I am a little bit sceptical, if I'm being honest. I think there is that middle ground. I think that we're probably, it is more in reality. So as Ant's talking about, you know, it's more about things being delivered to us, you know, getting, knowing where they are, how to track them, what to do with them. And maybe a package turns up and, you know, the bot doesn't throw it over my back fence. Like, I'd count that as a win. So, you know, ideally, you know, I'm sitting in my car in 20 years time, you know, going where I want to go, and I'm doing it independently. I am sceptical on whether or not the technology can get us there, but I am always ever hopeful.
Robin, travel and transport, an increasing area of interest for us in the inclusive design team at RNIB. How do we make these things accessible for blind and partially sighted people?
Well, I had my first drive. I had an 8-mile drive around Mountain View in California in 2018 in a self-driving car. And it gave me a lot of confidence because there was me, a low vision, top letter guy, driving around the city, navigating an oil spill, navigating a wobbly cyclist, a hesitant pedestrian, and lots of motorists that were making gestures. And it was very smooth and successful. So I think for us, you know, what we need to do is to continue to work with companies like Waymo and others who are developing self-driving cars to make sure that the systems, the software and hardware, but also the critically the user interface, is as accessible as it can be for anyone with any kind of disability. So it's going to greet you when you walk towards the car, give you some orientation clues using your mobile device to get you to the car, introduce itself, confirm the nature of the trip. Perhaps you're going to pick up a friend en route to the cinema. It'll tell you that we're going to pick that friend up and where we're going to do it. And it'll also give you the opportunity to interact with the system using voice, using text via your app, and potentially using other mechanisms as well. So it's about making sure that every element of the design is user-friendly and responsive and as inclusive as it can be. Because I think, like Stacey, I'm super excited by probably one thing above all else, and that is spontaneity. The spontaneity of being able to decide, do you know what? The sun's coming out. It's a really nice afternoon after all. Let's just jump in the car and go to North Berwick. And actually, do you know what? When we're on the way there, we're going to stop in at Nardini's, or Luca's rather, and we're going to get a nice ice cream, fantastic ice cream shop in Musselburgh. We're going to do that en route. Now, were we to make a decision to do that using public transport or using a taxi, it really would take the spontaneity out of it because it would be a bit of a hassle. I want to navigate the vehicle, make a decision en route. Do you know what? We're going to pop in and visit Auntie Susan for a cup of tea because we're a little bit ahead of schedule. I want to make those driver and destination decisions on the fly and have them happen.
Stacey, privacy, safety, intellectual property often intersect with technology and accessibility. How do you see public policy and legislation evolving to balance the interests of content creators and the need for accessibility, especially thinking about AI generated content?
So I think it's a very important question. Privacy has become much more of a hot topic, and you can't even visit a web page these days without having to check several boxes. Yes, you can track me. Yes, I'll read the cookie. You can have the cookies, all that sort of stuff. I think one of the things that's been current throughout this thread, though, of conversation is it's all about choice. And it goes back to what Ant said, and I completely agree. So for me personally, I don't mind if it knows I like coffee or a particular brand of tea or I like a, you know, I want to go to Game or Starbucks. I don't really mind if it knows where my location is, but that's my personal preference. And there will be other people who will absolutely not be into that. And so I think there's going to have to be a lot of work done to make sure that people's choices are clear, and that if they don't want to share certain aspects of their data, it doesn't limit their experience, particularly for people with disabilities. And so I think there will be a lot of legislation that will play into that. One of the things that we're looking at just now, very briefly, is the European Accessibility Act, which is all about, I guess, the freedom of digital accessibility and an enhancement of it. But even as part of that, intellectual property is a massive topic. And so even if we have, you know, AI describing our image content, the owner of those images has to be okay with the descriptions that are coming out, because actually, it's particularly in education scripts, if you're looking at it and actually that AI hasn't described it the way that the author had intended, it could alter the perception. And so there's a lot to think about, and there's a lot of work to be done on it. But again, I think a lot of it also goes back to the individual's choice and making sure that their choice doesn't hinder their experience.
And of course, we're right in the midst of the debate around, you know, whose content are these large language models trained on, and you know, what's permission given? And I imagine you've thought through some of these ethical issues. You seem quite happy to let the machines kind of have your whereabouts and your preferred, I don't know, flavour of things and how your biometrics are playing out. Gen Y and Z and beyond, they seem less bothered about this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a generational or an evolving attitude towards the data conversation. But most importantly, it's a trade. So it's, what do I get back for giving my information? You know, and I think we see younger generations saying, you know, it's almost an expectance, you know, serve me better, predict me better. They want that enhancement in the service and are prepared to give up something for it. I agree with that, and that's the bit I'm prepared to do. You know, if it makes my life easier, if it recommends the right coffee shop or it recommends the right stall based on my preference, I'd see that as an enhancement. That's one thing, and I think that will naturally evolve over time, but people should always be given the choice of, you know, what they want to do and what they're prepared to surrender. The other bit goes back to this money again, and I can't get away from it, but, you know, if you can't follow the money, you know, you are the money is usually the point, your data or your experience. And if we think to, let's say, move the conversation to that point of AI generated information, there'll be three different models. One will be a free service, but the return is that they'll advertise to me. So I'm surrendering some data because I'm saying, you know, I'm using AI to generate information on X, Y, and Z. So it would then send adverts that are tailored to me based on X, Y, and Z. And it would sell that advertising space, and that's how it would sustain that model. Option number two is that I'm using this more regularly and I want to subscribe to this service. I'm prepared to pay for it. So it's AI as a service. But then brings us into that third area, which is, well, what am I using that information for? If it's to help my life or my day or improve my experience of something, then it has to be a fee. But if I'm using that for commercial gain, to do my job or to do my job that, you know, is then allowing me to sell products to a customer or serve a customer in a different way, then there's another fee. So I think we'll see those three models. One will be, you can use AI and we'll advertise to you in return. It's a bit like search now. And, you know, while we get very precious about our data, and quite rightly so in some cases, we surrender heaps anyway. You know, who reads the user agreement on the smartphone when it comes through? Not many, you know, so we don't understand the data we're already surrendering. And in search options, you know, we more or less actively give it up in lots of cases. I know that's improved now, but it's still gaining lots of information from us. That fee-based service that says, I'm going to use it, I'm going to be a regular user, and then that, you know, I'm using this for commercial gain will be very different again. So I think attitudes will change, but choice is important. Absolutely. I'm not saying, you know, my view of surrendering data in return for service is going to work for everybody. I know it's not. But then, you know, there will be this evolution of generative AI as a service. It's bound to come.
Robin, some of RNIB's customers are potentially at a vulnerable point in terms of their, you know, to use that sort of horrible phrase, sight loss journey, coming to terms with, you know, their new normal. How do we navigate these issues around privacy and safety when it comes to the future of technology?
I think we've got to be very careful about how we communicate all of this. You know, we're living through an age where the concept of privacy is changing. You know, the concept of what privacy means to a 40-year-old versus a 20-year-old versus a 15-year-old, it's changed massively. As Ant said, the concept of ownership is changing. People are renting stuff. They're giving their data in return. So I think it's about how do we communicate this with our community? And I know that it's one of the things our volunteers, our Tech for Life volunteers have been quite involved in, is making sure that, that people actually understand a lot of this. A lot of older customers are really baffled by, you know, the disclaimers that they're expected to sign. We've only got to think back to when we signed up for a Gmail account, right? Anyone remember that? Did anyone read the disclaimer that we signed? You know, it was basically saying you can have my data and you can do with it what you want, and in return you'll have access to these services. This is about how do we communicate that with people, but also how do we make sure that tech companies are held to account and actually will be clear and will present and share what it is that's happening to your data. You know, I think we're going to see some interesting potentially discoveries and judgments made in that domain over the coming year, just in terms of how much transparency is there, how much are people being told about what's happening to their data. It's, you know, there's no quick fix. I think we've got to, all of us, it's incumbent on all of us to make sure that the people around us, and particularly people who might struggle to access information, actually enter into that dialogue and understand it. And being cognizant of the fact that it's challenging to understand it. You know, it's not clear cut and straightforward. You need to read, you need to understand and come to your own decision about it. I'm pretty relaxed about my data. If my data, me giving my data to a provider is going to result in a better experience for me, I'm cool with that. Other people might not be. It's a very individual thing.
There's just one other piece on this as well, is there could be a complete game changer across the entire tech industry here. If somebody was to an innovator, an entrepreneur, was to say, well, actually, let's flip this around. Let's provide you with equipment, devices, services, that don't gain this information unless you're happy to give it. So, for example, if we took a new entrant to the market that gave us an amazing smart device, maybe it's a phone, maybe it's a watch, maybe it's AR, and there is no surrender of information at all, whether we agree or not, we are completely private. But yet then we choose to offer up information. So for example, if you're using an AR type solution, you were going shopping, you could say uncloak, and it would then, you know, you'd be available. The marketeers could hear anything they want to, they could offer you a coffee, they could offer you, but you never give your personal information. You tell them what your preferences are, you tell them a little bit about yourself, but you never give up your name. The minute you leave that store or that shopping centre, you could say cloak, and it would then immediately cut off all of those offers that were coming into you. And again, if we follow the money, the people marketing to you would know that, in my case, a 48-year-old male with a family has entered the shopping centre. We guess that he needs a coffee, or maybe it's a beer or whatever it might be, or a burger. But they wouldn't have to guess or presume what might be in that shopping centre. They'd know I'm there. The income generated from me surrendering that information, but I get the luxury of privacy by choosing this on and off cloak and just how much information I want to share. So I could go a stage further and it could share my calendar of birthdays. So it'd say, and while you're in the store, we know it's Valentine's Day or it's your son's birthday or whatever it might be, and we've got some offers for you as well. And again, when I leave that store, a cloak goes up and that's it. I stop the information. So because of the whole commercial model of the tech industry and how they make money, I don't see this being an immediate thing, but what if? This could be quite incredible.
Listening to all of this is our co-host, Callum Stoneman. And before we wrap up, Callum, I just wondered if you had any thoughts or questions for our panel.
Yes, I've just been sat here quietly for a good few minutes, which makes a change for me. But no, fascinating, fascinating discussion. And I think, do you know, I can't disagree with any of that. You know, it's difficult to predict the future. You know, when we got told about this show and when we came up with the idea of doing the 2043, I was thinking, that's just impossible. I mean, look at the last 6 months or so with ChatGPT and Be My AI and all these other things that have come out. And I think I just can't wait to see the accessibility benefits of this. I mean, I think the bit that fascinates me the most out of everything that we've discussed so far is the driverless vehicles, because I would love the idea of just having my own car. I think it was Stacey saying this, you know, you'd just love to be able to just go out and get in the car and just, you know, go somewhere. And then on the way, if you think, oh, I want to get some food, you know, add that stop in and it'll stop there for you. And, you know, it could even have your order ready for you for when you pull up, you know, and your food's just there waiting, or your coffee or whatever. But I think the biggest obstacle is going to be the laws and the regulations before blind people can have them. I think that's going to be the bit that would need some catching up. But no, I think it's really exciting times, especially with AI and virtual reality. Or, you know, we've got, for example, okay, this isn't 2043, but we've got the Vision Pro from Apple coming up, hopefully next year. And that in itself is due to be a game changer, and that's 1 year away. So, you know, imagine 20 years.
So before we close, I'm going to come to each of you and ask you to identify what you think is the key challenge that we still need to overcome to ensure inclusion when thinking about the future of accessibility and technology. So who fancies taking this one first?
Shall I go for it? So I think the key challenge is genuinely embedding the principles of inclusive design, not a one-hit wonder where you create a great product or a great interface, but developing the ability to repeatedly recreate and develop and advance a product so that it becomes more and more inclusive. Because so many companies are able to do a good example of a site or a service or an app or a website, then they come to do, you know, a reassessment of it, a redesign, and it's back to the drawing board. So I think the real skill and the real step change that I want to see is that genuine embedding of inclusive design in a way that actually shows a consistently upward curve as we go into the future.
If I could just add to that as well, because I completely agree with you, Robin. I think it's the idea of everything being born accessible and really getting into that mindset and staying in that mindset. And so it's not only born accessible, its entire lifespan is accessible. And I think the key thing that needs to happen in order for that to be achieved as well is to have people who will use those accessibility features at the forefront in designing that technology, testing that technology, being part of it is crucial. And so not having a solution where, you know, it's brought to us after the fact, after it's been designed, and saying, does this work for blind and partially sighted people? And actually the feedback suggests that not really. But if you'd involved people from the get-go, then it could have been an entirely different experience. And I think we're starting to see a bit more of that, and I'd love to see it ramped up a lot. I'd love to see the people that are going to benefit the most from these experiences actually having a steer and a say in how these things are designed, how they're put out into the market, how they're tested, and how they're maintained.
And if your book has a message, for me it was everything we've learned today, great, but actually to really thrive in this brave new world, we are all going to have to be prepared to go on this constant journey of self-improvement and be willing to learn new skills, new things to navigate each and every day.
We are. The world is going to change at such pace, and this is the bit that's going to catch the unprepared out. So, you know, my message throughout the book, you know, why did I write the book? Yes, it was to give a vision of what I thought the future of technology would do, but it was there to help people. And that is around expect the unexpected. You know, technology, invention and innovation will come at such pace over our lifetime that, you know, I genuinely predict that, you know, we've seen some incredible technology. We haven't seen anything yet. You know, there's going to be far more. AI is going to enable so much more. We can often feel as though it's too technical, and we run lots of workshops in my day job. And, you know, if I had a pound for every time somebody said, well, I'm not technical, right? You know, I'd be a wealthy man. We have to be technical. We don't have to understand how a large language model works, but we have to understand what does it do? How might it change our jobs and how might it impact our lives? That's all we need to understand. We can then make some informed decisions around what it might do. So constantly learning and unlearning, if that makes sense, is absolutely critical. But as I say, not to, you know, fear that it's too technical. Actually, often a lot of these things are quite simple, and we'll leave the technical stuff to AI, right? That will do all of the technical stuff. We'll just be the interface and the interaction with it.
And we're going to have to work together, all of us, you know, regardless of our backgrounds or areas or abilities, we're going to have to collaborate to get this stuff right.
Can I just underline that with one crucial thing that actually excites me and it underpins everything that we've been talking about? And that's the progression in the social inclusion aspect that we will see through the emergence of technology. Because how can somebody ask the person you're with, you know, what does he or she want to drink? If you're just sitting there with a piece of technology, right? They're not going to ask your mobile phone or your wristwatch or your bone conductor earbuds. They're going to be speaking directly to you. And so the more technology evolves, the more independent blind and partially sighted people can be. And I think then the more progressive we'll see society. We'll see a society where they don't go, can we employ a blind and partially sighted person? Or should we be, is that person, that person must be their carer, right? So we'll speak to them instead of the person directly. I that's the key thing that I'd love to see that underpins all of this change, is that in 20 years time, I don't have to deal with that on a daily basis, because the world doesn't think like that anymore.
Stacey Scott, Ant Morse, Robin Spinks and Callum Stoneman, thank you so much for joining us on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, we're always delighted to hear from you here at Tech Talk, and we've received an email from Kelly, who writes, congratulations to 20 years of RNIB Connect Radio. Long may it continue for another 20 years. Listening to Dave using the Franklin Talking Dictionary brought back lots of memories. I had one of these and loved it. I'd say the one piece of technology that changed my life most was the Opticon. Ah, Kelly, yes, I do remember the Opticon. The Opticon tactile converter was rectangular, about the size of a portable tape recorder. Do you know what we're talking about here, Callum Stoneman? A portable tape recorder?
I know a portable tape recorder. Never heard of the Opticon, though.
And a camera which was about the size of a penknife, which you attached it with a thin cable, and then you put your finger onto a template, and then you moved the camera around on little kind of rollers, and then you got sort of under your fingers sort of vibrations and pins that kind of gave you a tactile sensation of whatever the camera could detect. And Kelly says that this is how she learned to recognize printed text and even some handwriting.
Interesting. So it gave you like a, not braille obviously, but was it like a almost like a tactile kind of graphic type thing in those days?
Yes, yeah, I would say so. Yeah. But you kept your finger still, so you have a little metal plate on which you put your finger, and then there are tiny holes in the plate, and then there are little pins that kind of come up to reflect, you know, sort of what the camera is perceiving in a, you know, in a very sort of monochrome type way. But it was inverted so that you know, if there was writing, for example, on a piece of paper, then you would be able to move the camera across and feel those characters. Discontinued in 1996, Kelly tells us.
Before I was born.
Well, there you go. A great way to learn how to, you know, write your signature.
Yes. Yeah, interesting.
Well, good to hear from you, Kelly. Thank you so much for tuning in and contacting us here at Tech Talk. We've also heard from Mayor Liam, who says, my favourite piece of tech that I've used since 2005 is Braille labels, Braille labelling devices. I use a mixture of giant print and Braille in my daily life, but use Braille labels daily to label pictures, makeup, packaging, my medication pill box, CDs, and much more.
I think sometimes the low-tech solutions are the best ones, aren't they? You know, just stick a Braille label on there. I know we've got all these fancy OCR apps and labelers and all this AI stuff going on, but honestly, just if a Braille label does the job, then, you know, fantastic.
Yep, and I think Maya would agree. So thank you so much, Maya Liam, for getting in contact with us here at Tech Talk. Also, on social media, and you can find RNIB Connect Radio on social media, we've been asking for your memories. Kirsten Roberts on X says that, you know, unquestionably, it's the iPhone that has made the biggest difference. And Merly126 on Threads says that using VoiceOver on the iPhone and Narrator on Windows PCs have made the biggest difference. Let us know if you're following RNIB Connect Radio on your social media platform of choice. Stay in touch. Okie doke, that's it for our crystal ball gazing this week. We really appreciate all your communication and listening. And if you like anything you hear on Tech Talk, do spread it, do tell a friend, do share the show. But that's it, Callum Stoneman, we are done. We're very much looking forward to next week when, Callum Stoneman, you're going to be speaking with the Scottish Tech Army about the all new Soundscape.
Yes, yeah, looking forward to that.
Indeed. But if you'd like to contact us between now and then, it's the usual address, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's it. We are done. Thank you very much. And from Callum Stoneman.
Bye for now.
And myself. Bye-bye.